And welcome to TNT, the Technology and Things podcast. Your host, Paul Ferraro, is a former IT exec and currently a technology advisor. Jeff Kruger, a fellow technology enthusiast, is the co-host. They both spent many years working for a Fortune 500 company and are both passionate about leadership, technology, and the community.
Welcome to another edition of Technology and Things. I'm joined today by Sean Neal, who is our director of networking and digital. I don't know, you've got some digital experience title, but Sean is an expert in wireless and networking. And so he is going to be helping me today with co-hosting. And so I'm looking forward to that. So hello, Sean. How are you doing?
Great. Super excited to do this and chat with QRT today. And my first Technology and Things podcast as well. So excited about that.
That's right. So yeah, it's good to have you on finally. We wanted to wait till we actually had our had everything figured out before we had you on. So, but you mentioned it. So we have the founder of Aruba Networks, Kirti Mulkoti, joining us today. And so we are definitely jazzed about that. He is currently the president of the Aruba division within HP. Aruba started around 2001 or 2002, somewhere around there. So we're going to talk to him about some of those early days and all that and kind of where they're at today and pick his brain on all kinds of topics. So it should be a good session.
Yeah, it'd be great. I think, they're making up the kind of the cornerstone of my business right now. And I think to watch them evolve as they have over the last couple decades has been pretty, pretty amazing. So, and I've been able to spend some time with Kirti in the past. I'm super excited to hear what he has to say. And looking for, a nice sort of more personal conversation too.
Yeah. That's the point is we want to have fun with it and be able to just kind of go anywhere we want to. So he should be joining soon. Other little exciting announcement is that we are building a dedicated Technology and Things studio. That is going to be great. I think we're going to be, that'll be available at the beginning of 2021. That is underway right now. Construction is all underway. So, that the podcast keeps getting bigger and better. And so look forward to sharing some pictures with you guys soon on that. But right now, just a little teaser on that we are going to have a dedicated studio. So that's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Fancy.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about you some more, Sean, when we got some time. How did you get into the wireless space?
Yeah, so I jumped into...
Or maybe even IT. Like, how did you get into IT?
Yeah, like, so... In general. Yeah, sure. So for IT, I kind of started out, I was a kid whose dad owned his own small business. And so I became the de facto computer guy. Early, 90s, just had a lot of opportunity to like help around the office. It was an area that I liked. I had an affinity for, computers and, even had a grandfather who was in the early days of computing and had his own computer at his university in the 50s.
Wow.
And he actually I got my first computer when I was two, the IBM 8080, and I've had one since. So it's been just kind of something that I grew up with, and went up going to school for it at Michigan State. I worked in IT there, and it just kind of stuck. But yeah, as far as wireless goes, so when I was still in school, wireless wasn't much of a thing yet. We use it primarily for connecting, bridging and connecting buildings that were far across campus into the main campus. And I had it out more like a couple years down the road. I moved out to California, landed my first consulting job, and they needed somebody to pick up and run with wireless as a new technology. We're a real small company of nine, and I opted to do it. It seemed like, you know, something fun. We had, you know, people who were invested in routing and, you know, routing and switching and security, but this Wi-Fi thing was new and seemed like a good opportunity to jump in. So I went for it, and 20 years later, I'm still doing it and still love it. So yeah, it's good.
That's awesome. No, that's great. That's great to hear. It's always, I always kind of interested in to see how people move from, sometimes, you know, move from IT into the product space, which I think actually Kirti did. He was in IT in at one point and went into product management. So I'm interested to talk to him about that and kind of how that happened. Cause I think a lot of people in IT sort of dream of getting out of IT. You know, it's like, you know, when you're sort of in a customer support type of role, you look at other opportunities or other things and you're like, how do I make that leap out of there? And so I think that's always an interesting thing to see how people do that. And some people like doing, you know, they don't want to get out of it. But I think that was always when I was doing it, it was always kind of like, oh, you know, you see people kind of move out of it into the business and things like that. And I like kind of seeing those stories. So with Kirti, what's most on top of mind for you right now? On what are you thinking about with in regards to talking to him? And we get someone like that on our program here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you know, since the acquisition, I think a lot of us were worried about the acquisition. Actually, one of my good friends, his very first day starting at Aruba was the day the acquisition was announced. And I called him up. I was like, "Hey, what do you think about working for HPE?" And he was nervous. but I will say that you know, the approach that HPE took was different than what they had done in the past. In fact, they basically, you know, even though they acquired Aruba, they, you know, move the networking division under Aruba and kind of left all the autonomy with Dom and Kirti, Dom being the other founder with Kirti. And, you know, and it's really, really flourished over the last few years. And we see, you know, a number of benefits of, you know, having the kind of capital that, like, you know, someone like an HPE brings to the table. Really talking to Kirti about, you know, what they've been doing with that, both, We've seen some fantastic acquisitions. We've seen a lot of development cycles and some new products. I'd love to chat with them a little bit about that and where things are heading. I think there's some really exciting stuff that they're bringing to the forefront for our customers. Thanks. And that's really what I'm looking forward to chatting with them about.
When was the acquisition of Aruba into HP?
It was in, I want to say March of 15.
Okay. Yeah. 2015.
Right around there. I think it was announced. I think that's when it was announced. So. Cool.
All right. Well, Mr. Mulcoti is with us here. So I'm going to go ahead and admit him in.
Fantastic.
Hi, Kirti here.
Hey, good morning, Kirti. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Excellent.
Good morning, Kirti.
Morning.
Oh, there you are. I like that background.
Thank you.
Nice, nice. Well, my name is Paul Ferraro. I'm the host of our Technology and Things podcast. And I'm joined today by Sean Neal, who is our director of our wireless practice at Evotech. And I think you guys might have talked in the past.
Yes, we have. Hi, Sean.
Oh, good to see you.
See you too.
That's awesome. Well, so thank you, Kirti, for joining us today. It's really really an honor and a privilege to have you on, and looking forward to getting into it and talking about some of your career and what's going on at Aruba and just all kinds of different topics. So again, thank you.
Excellent. Happy to be here with all of you.
You know, the first thing, I was kind of doing a little research on you and watched some of your presentations, and I kind of came from the more the system side. So my background's more in the, you know, Unix and storage and all that kind of stuff. So I wasn't super familiar with you. And so I kind of was doing some research looking into your story and all that's obviously very impressive. One of the things I wanted to kind of ask you about first off was I think you started out in IT doing networking. Yeah. And I wanted to kind of hear a little bit about that and kind of how you, I think you made the jump from that into like in the product space, I believe, but love to hear a little bit about the early days there and kind of, I think that's important just to set the stage and see kind of where you got your start a little bit and kind of as we get going here.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was foundational for me. I mean, there could not have been a better place to start a career in IT than in the IT industry, I mean, than by walking a mile in the foot of my customers. And so I was one of them, right? My first job was as a network engineer for Intel. And, you know, it was the early 90s. We still didn't have the World Wide Web back then, but the network was still important to building out the processor line that Intel was building, obviously. And the Pentium was the big project that Intel was embarking on when I joined. They needed this high-speed LAN to run the simulations and the circuit designs and everything else that goes into building a processor. And I was effectively in charge of architecting and building out the network along with my team to essentially upgrade from what at that time was a shared Ethernet network to what was coming up as a switched Ethernet, you know, kind of a network to increase capacity, et cetera. And that experience was foundational in many ways. Technically, I think it gives you a great grounding from everything what I call layer zero issues with things like cables gone bad or patch panels or what have you, all the way up to application level issues with file servers and why things are not behaving the way they should. And, you know, ultimately the truth is in the packets, right? As we all say, so we always bring out the packet analyzer and look at what's actually happening and troubleshoot no matter what layer the issue is in. And of course, also getting a grounding in what I call layer 8, layer 9, which is really the organizational aspects of running a successful IT shop within these enterprises. So it was very up close personal view of day in the life of IT people. I started as a network engineer, graduated to become a network architect, I ran a small group there and ran through a bunch of different projects. And at that time I got close to some of the, as I was pushing the innovation side within IT, I got close to some of the innovative companies at that time and got to know Jayashree Ullal, who's now the CEO of Arista. She was the VP of marketing for Crescendo, which was this tiny startup doing switching, and they got acquired by Cisco. And so after they got acquired, Jayashree called and she was like, hey, would you consider joining me as a technical marketing engineer? And I love that. That break towards, okay, now that I've consumed the products and built them in practice, what does it actually look like to actually build those products for the people, for myself, right? And I keep putting myself back in those shoes. What would I want if I put myself back in their shoes? And that, I think, even to this day, it informs what we do. It informs how we do things. Having empathy for the networking group. In fact, the name of the company, even Aruba, came from the motivation from it, came from, you know, what I viewed as the day in the life of a IT person, which was always hair on fire. And my company was like, hey, this is the place you go for peace. And that's how Aruba came to be.
I like that. I like what you said about, a couple things that stuck out was the, I'd never heard before, was the layer 8 and 9. I like that with the sort of the whole organizational part of IT. And then, you know, having empathy for your, you know, customers and the people using the products is also cool. And I like the peace at the end there too. Like, you know, having a place that's, you know, a peaceful place instead of the hair on fire.
Correct. Correct. When you think of Aruba, it's your peaceful place.
I like that a lot. You were doing technical marketing type of thing. I think you did that for some time. And then you've talked before about kind of stepping away from, I think you had a good gig and everything, and you stepped away from that right around the time that I think right before the whole kind of dot-com crash, and you were working on building a new company, which was kind of a crazy time to do that. But obviously it worked out okay in the end. What motivated you to go step out on your own and want to go do that? What was driving that?
You know, the foundational desire is to have an impact on the industry and try to figure out what's next and see if you could go make that happen. And there's two ways to do that. There's obviously you try to do that within the organization that you're in, or you do that, stake out on your own and go believe in it so passionately that you want to go do this. For me, I was in a startup that I felt was not going to a good place. And so by definition, I was in a place where, you know, this is not going to work. So I needed to go do something else, and I felt like the timing was right to go stake out on my own and do something that I felt in the market. And I certainly felt at the time that, you know, networking had gone through a period of hypergrowth with switching and, you know, everybody had Ethernet everywhere to all the desks, not only one Ethernet port, but even multiple Ethernet ports going to the voice over IP lines and going to printers and the like, right? In fact, if I remember right, we used to have 4 Ethernet ports to every desk, right? And so I just felt like, you know, that there's what's next and what could be different. And I just felt like the moment you walk away from the desk, there's no connectivity at that time. And you go to conference rooms, there was a mess of cables everywhere for those that wanted connectivity in a conference room. And I just felt like wireless was a natural technology to enable that easy connectivity and wherever you are, including a desk. And as I dug into it, I just felt there was so many problems technically that needed to be solved. But if we could solve it, and that's a challenge, right? It's like, hey, a lot of challenges. Can I figure out a team that can help me solve all these problems? And if it did, then it was clear to me back then that it would dominate and become the primary means of connecting. And it turned out to be true. So that's why I think ultimately the bet really matters. And what I tell anybody who asks me is make big bets. Don't look at fixing little things. They'll take care of themselves. It's just make a big bet. And I just felt wireless was going to be a massive movement. And I just wanted to be a part of that.
It's funny you say that, Kirti. So we were chatting right before you joined, and Paul was asking kind of how I got into wireless. And for me, it was, at the time I joined my first consulting job, right? A real small startup company. I was super excited. I was like the ninth person in the company up there. We had people who understood routing and switching and firewalls. But wireless was this new thing that nobody really knew whether it would work or whether it would take off. And they needed somebody to try to figure it out and play with it in the lab and see if it was something our customers would even be interested in. And so as a new guy, I was like, sure, why not? I'll give it a shot, just to, to see its evolution over the last, for me, 20-ish years, wireless life is a little bit longer than that. But it's the steps we've made in making it more consumable and solving so many problems is really the fun part about it, right? And the connectivity to the people, to people who can't sit in a desk all day, right? Like your healthcare workers and your educators and, all these people, solving real problems for them is a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. I mean, it's the same thing for me, right? I'm a networking guy, but not necessarily had a lot of exposure. In fact, I actually remember deploying in my first job some wireless technology. It was not called Wi-Fi back then, but it was still from,
NCR WaveLAN. I don't know if you'll remember that. And it was like a 1 megabit per second Wi-Fi wireless LAN connection. And so I was always fascinated by that. And but who knew that, one day iPads would come along and iPhones would come along and smartphones, tablets. And today, if you look at laptops, even there's no Ethernet ports on them for the most part, right? It's you got to search specifically for laptops that have Ethernet. And so the world has flipped, completely flipped, and we rely on wireless now. And if you look at even how this call is being recorded, right, we expect voice, video, data, everything flowing over Wi-Fi. So it's become fundamentally the de facto connection for everything we do, which is frankly more than I expected, the success of Wi-Fi.
I mean, we expect that reliability to be there, you know, it's like, especially with all the, everything going on with, COVID, right? I'm home more with the wife and kids and everything's over Wi-Fi, and I find out immediately if there's a hiccup, right? And, it's like, oh, my, Call of Duty stopped working or whatever the case may be, right? Everybody depends on it.
Yeah, you made me think about something that's a little different about wireless than some of the other disciplines. It sort of combines both the tech world, the traditional tech world, with the physical world, right? Where you have to look at, spatial issues and rooms and all these different things that most of the other disciplines don't really think about that stuff. It's just, it's all kind of in the virtual world, and it definitely bring a lot more challenges and issues to the table with doors and walls and trees and all these things. Sean and I were just on a call before this about with a customer talking about trees that were potentially in the way.
Absolutely.
Kind of funny.
The environment matters, right? It's a big deal. We don't normally think of that in wired networking. We try to design neat, copper Cat 6, Cat 6E, Cat 7, whatever you have, right? And make sure you're terminating it right. And you've got a high fidelity signal. But the wireless is exactly the opposite, right? I mean, it's a fading signal and you got to design it right. And there's a lot of, I would say, opportunity to innovate is kind of how I see it in the context of, looking at the RF environment. And in fact, our most recent work we are doing around AI, applying AI to improving signal quality, signal strength, tuning, troubleshooting. There's a lot of really cool technology that we can bring to bear to help, what people like Sean and I used to do in the early days with site surveys and trying to get everything right up front.
So I wanted to play off one of your comments. You talked about, big bets and opportunity to innovate. There was a major transition for Aruba with that, HPE acquisition, but I think that's turned out to be a big shot in the arm for you guys, right? I think it's been pretty impressive. Can you talk about that a little bit? Like, what that was like going through that, the big kind of HPE making a big bet on you, and what that's done to your opportunity to innovate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for us, this happened. It's been 5 years now since we have been a part of HPE, which has been phenomenal. And Aruba was successful on its own as a wireless innovator, and we had built a security A plus wireless practice between ClearPass and the Wi-Fi products that we had. And, we were a billion-dollar company from a revenue perspective, public, and doing quite well on our own. But we knew fully well that to really get to the next level, that we needed a big brother. So we were in search of that big brother, either a partner or someone who we could become a part of. We were not necessarily looking to be acquired, to be honest. We were looking more for partners who could help us get to the next level, because beyond technology, customers are looking for the operational capabilities to support them, especially the large customers from a global perspective, the services capabilities, the support functions, feet on the street. Like, there's a lot that goes into helping our customers and partners end to end. And so that was the reason why we were looking for that. And typically when customers think of projects, Wi-Fi is a part of the project, right? They're looking at a digital transformation. They're looking at a digital workplace. So there's some higher project that ends up getting implemented. Not that there are no pure wireless projects, there are, but many projects, typically wireless is a component of it. And so we wanted to figure out a way to get inserted into those projects, and which is why we were in search. And when Antonio called and said, hey, we would love to figure out a way to come together, the appeal to me was that we had HP had a very strong wired networking business. Yep. And that was required, even though the user side has flipped over to wireless, everything behind the access point is still wired, right? And so customers who were looking at wireless as a primary connection, they started to ask us saying, hey, if you are the primary network, I'll give you the opportunity to design the whole thing for me, whether it's in a campus or in a branch. And I think combining with HP gave us that opportunity to go become more of a full stack provider of the network. And the one thing that we always wanted was, and everybody had a fear that, you know, you get absorbed by a big company and then you get lost in the mix, right? And that didn't happen because Antonio basically said that not only are you guys going to come over, we're going to reverse integrate the HP networking business into Aruba and let you guys continue to operate as Aruba, a Hewlett Packard Enterprise company. And even 5 years later, that kind of mode of operation is still true, which means it allows us to keep going from an innovation perspective. Fortunately, the HP networking team, which is a great, was a well-kept secret within HP, they very much have that underdog mentality because the big business is the server business and the storage business, and they were trying to make their mark in the company and in the market. And so the cultural fit could not have been better. And both are scrappy, both are innovative, both want to go make a mark in the market. So the biggest success to me was that we were able to take two organizations, pretty large, 2,000 people in each organization, potentially a combustible combination if things didn't work, but we were able to bring it together organizationally. And that to me is probably the greatest success that I see is, of course, the business has done well and it's grown, which is phenomenal, but in large part, it's because the organization blended well together and that we were able to keep it going. And so I think that formula for innovation, formula for supporting our customers, you see it right behind me, the cultural value of who we are, is pretty fundamental, and it survived the acquisition and it continues to grow in that from that perspective. And you know, we're continuing to double down, both organic innovation as well as inorganic, right? The latest big bet being Silver Peak, to now expand what we do from the campus and branch into the cloud, so that we can actually now take these campus and branch networks, connect them directly into the cloud, which is the next big shift. Especially in the pandemic era, I see a massive shift towards SD-WANs from proprietary private WANs. And so I just want to keep that momentum going and keep innovating in a disruptive way in the market.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the foundation of Evotech was really, you know, who needed another VAR in 2014 when we were starting, right? But we saw an opportunity in that you had the guys who were the traditional data center companies. You had the guys who were traditional cloud companies, and they were both sort of advocating, like, either push everything towards the cloud or everything towards the data center. And we saw that there was room kind of in the middle to be, you know, to embrace the hybrid cloud, right? And the idea that it's going to be somewhere in the middle. People's data is going to kind of live anywhere, and it needs to be accessible all the time, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was funny when I came over and joined the team, they weren't really sure how to leverage a mobility practice, but I, you know, kind of came with one, right? That's kind of how I started explaining. It was like getting everyone just connected to their data wherever they're at, right? And they're consuming it. And I really think that, to your point, I'm starting to merge in like SD-WAN and doing, you know, the hybrid connections directly to the cloud from a branch office per se is exactly that, right? Is we're in a spot now where, you know, you can be mobile, but always be connected to your data, whether that is, you know, yeah, your Wi-Fi, whether that is cellular based, you know, or whatever. I mean, you can take that with you, and that's become the expectation of a, you know, a knowledge worker or anyone who's just consuming that data in real time, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think now even more than ever, especially in the pandemic era, where work from home has become like the de facto way we do things, right? The ability to take that connection home and connect securely into your work environment has become extremely important. And that's one of the areas that we're seeing great demand. It was very interesting, actually, when I did, obviously, wireless, it was almost like a technology challenge because we bet on the ability to do centralized encryption in our architecture. It was a very, key bet. And the idea there was that you take the encrypted packets from whatever the encryption method you were using, WPA2 or WPA in Wi-Fi, and not only do it over the air, but extend it all the way to the data center, to the controller. And so the challenge I gave my engineering team was, show me you can do it over the internet. If you claim it's so secure, you should be able to deploy this access point literally anywhere, even across the internet, and bloom an SSID and connect networks back. And so they accomplished that. It was almost like we did not see, honestly, that it would become the way in which we would connect into corporate environments back then. And initial demand for this came from financial services. And where the first time around, there was a need for this business continuity kits, where if there was a business continuity event, that they could deploy people to work from home and continue to do trading and these kinds of things on Wall Street. But today, that technology, and we have evolved the technology, obviously, to not only connect to data center, but to clouds. But that ability to work from home has become a foundational part of the story that you mentioned. The edge is pretty much anywhere now, right? Wherever the user is where the edge is. And how do you bring them to the cloud?
Yeah, and I think, like you mentioned before, you were talking about some of the predictive, analysis, and some of that work is going to be really important when you've got everybody at home trying to figure out, what their network at home is and all that. My son came in yesterday and demanded that we change internet providers halfway throughout the day. And I was like, what analysis have you done to determine that? And he said, it's just too darn slow. And I'm like, I obviously don't have the right tools in place to let them know what's going on with our bandwidth.
No, but that is what you illustrate is exactly the challenge, right? From an end user perspective, Wi-Fi is the issue or the network is the issue. For the first time, I heard somebody say it's, change the service provider. Typically what I hear is change the Wi-Fi router,
right?
Get something else, right? But I think the home has become a mission critical environment.
Yeah.
And, kids doing classes, right? Spouses working. So it's like, everybody's in their rooms and, doing productive work. And it's no longer acceptable to have downtimes. And that's, I think, a big challenge, right? In the past, it's okay. When you watch, Netflix or YouTube or Hulu or whatever is your favorite streaming media, that relies on buffering, right? If there is a network glitch, it buffers a little bit more and you continue watching whatever you want. But when we are in live communications like this, which is what our entire days are made of, even a glitch instantly shows through. And so having that high-performing, predictive environment, which is able to give you the better connectivity, but also can tell you in advance that your communication is degrading and here is how to kind of fix it, is becoming extremely important.
So I'm guessing you guys are probably, the way you talked about the home, I hadn't really thought about that, but it's that the home has become this critical remote office essentially for everybody. I'm guessing you guys are probably, trying to look at that and figure out, how does that change, things for Aruba? What are you guys thinking about differently with products going forward and all that? I mean,
Yeah, absolutely. I think, as I said, our remote AP technology has been around for a decade now. But I think when we originally built it, we built it for connecting back to the data center with a VPN head-end controller. But today in a cloud world, what customers are saying is, I can't go deploy a controller in the cloud. So give me an opportunity to connect directly into these clouds. And so we've created a virtual version of the controller. We call it a virtual gateway that you can, take traffic directly into pretty much any of the clouds that are out there. And they're asking for basically the ability to deploy it very, very easily in a zero touch kind of a manner. So they can just, you know, order kit, you ship the kit over, you don't need to stage the kit, basically.
Right. Yeah.
You just take it out from the box, plug it into your network, and it comes up. So zero touch provisioning, cloud connectivity, visibility is a very, very big piece to your point, right? Imagine you're working from home and suddenly you have an outage or you have a problem. Your first line of support is your internet service provider, and you got to be on hold. And you know what that experience is like. And the question is, and at work, you're used to your help desk, which is much more instant, right? And you know yes. how things get work. So I think it's that lack of visibility that has raised the anxiety levels in IT departments. And the remote API allows you to now bring that visibility back to IT, saying, here is the environment, here is the experience, here's what's going on with the Wi-Fi side, here's what's going on with the internet side, and be a little bit more informed about the user experience and hopefully help them be a little bit more productive at home.
Yeah, and you can put that in the hands of somebody that's maybe on the help desk or somebody that's, you know, you don't have to get to some backline guru to find that out. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And we need to design the experience for end users, not just for IT.
Yeah.
Because the end user is the IT. I mean, they're deploying this access point, right?
That's
so it's
true.
No longer, you know, a site survey and, you know, all the technical skills I would expect from Sean and his team. You can't expect that necessarily, right, from an end user. So, but they expect it to just plug in and work, and you need the system to be able to guide that end user into deploying for themselves a better solution.
Yep.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the episode so far. For a chance to win a 32-inch HP LED monitor, please enter our raffle at evotech.com/TNT26. All entries must be submitted by September 18th, 2020. Drawing will be held and announced on September 21st, 2020. And now, back to the episode.
I always like when I get someone like yourself on our podcast is to talk to them about leadership and culture and things like that. And yeah, I know you've got your, I like the customer first, customer last is on your background there. And so obviously culture and all that's very important to you, I'm sure. How have you talked about this a little bit when you guys joined together with HP, what has been sort of the, your leadership style and how have you tried to go from this entrepreneurial startup type mode into the company that you are today? What's been sort of your guiding, you know, principles and leadership and how do you think about those kinds of things?
To me, it is about never forgetting your roots and where you came from. And the reason we were successful as a startup, why customers came to us, was because they expected a higher level of innovation, a higher level of support and service, and a more intimate relationship. And when companies grow and scale, which they must inevitably if they're successful, you cannot lose those foundational values that made you successful in the first place. And which is why to me that the two values that really are at the heart of Aruba is this value that we call customer first, customer last. And it really is to remind everyone that everything we do is for the customer, right? It's not, and when companies grow, departments grow, sometimes you lose that, right? And you try to figure out what another department's charter might be and what your charter might be. So there's these charter discussions that go on. And, you know, at some point you just go, who are we doing this for in the first place? And you work your way back. So I think that to me is pretty foundational to the culture of Aruba, and it's important. The other part is the idea of a biggest small company. The big being we want to grow, small being never forgetting that need for intimacy from the customer side. And those two are guiding. And ultimately, how you lead is, at least I lead, is being approachable, being humble, having empathy for every team member and every customer. And, you know, knowing every opinion matters. and that, you know, it's not a hierarchical top-down type culture. There is a time and place for doing that, where you need to be very hierarchical. But mostly in tech, what I see is people who are obviously very smart. They have figured out, you know, some pretty deep technological. They come from STEM backgrounds, and they all want their opinions and voices heard, and not get lost. And they want it to percolate up. And I never want it to be drowned. So even though it's challenging to touch every person in the organization, I try to keep an open door and meet with as many people as possible, and you know, and have forums like town halls and other leadership forums where you communicate that approach to the organization. And that typically, it's you know, culture. It's sort of you're born with it and it percolates. Whether you state it explicitly or not, you have a culture. So we took the approach of trying to explicitly state what are the tenets of our culture and communicating it. And then you have to behave in accordance with that culture on an everyday basis. So that's how I see. And in the tech industry, I think top-down doesn't work. You have to be a lot more democratic in how you actually approach the organization. Yep. And every opinion and voice matters and needs to be heard.
No, I think, yeah, your point about making sure that you're open, you're hearing everybody, that you're listening, you're getting feedback. That's huge. You know, if people feel like they're not able to get their, you know, ideas out there, then that's like the minute they'll bail, you know.
Yeah.
And like you said, these folks have a lot of options usually, and so they're not. They're not super worried about, you know, finding another gig or something like that. So it does become like that.
I mean, they want to feel connected. They want to feel like they're making an impact. They want to feel like they're advancing their careers and generally having fun and making money, which is also important.
Yep.
I think it all goes together, but more and more what I find is, you know, money, is important, but it's not primary. It's people are looking at impact, people looking at fun, the teams that they're a part of, the culture that they're a part of. And that's really what binds us together. Otherwise, you're right. The threads can weaken and you can find another job anytime, right? It's what organization do you want to be a part of is important, actually.
Yeah, fun is key.
fun is absolutely key. Man, life is too short. Life is too short.
That's why we do a podcast. We got to have some fun. I mean, it makes a lot more fun.
Yeah, no, this is great. This is great to engage with all of you as well.
So Jake, it's just to comment on some of what you said. And, you know, in my role, I've had a lot of chance to, you know, interact, you know, with some of the people that are, you know, pretty fairly high up in Aruba that are like your PLMs and Partha and some people on his team. You know, in general, I mean, so the culture, I think, is one, and giving some of the people passion, you know, to work for and those types of things. Are there any other, you know, sort of attracting the top talent? Are there any other things that you do specifically to attract the right people into Aruba and get them excited? Or is it really the culture that you guys are creating you think is the main engine?
No, I think it's culture is obviously foundational, and it's a reputation that you build over a period of time. And, you know, that reputation is something that will stay with you for a very long time. So I think doesn't happen overnight. It takes time and you got to be consistent and stick with it. So I think that is certainly an opportunity to bring people who are like-minded, potentially interested in a similar type of culture, to walk into the interview door. But then who actually comes into the building is dependent on really having the right interviewing process to not only ensure that they have the right skills, but they have the right cultural fit for the organization, because both are important. And so what we end up doing is in the process, not only do a technical assessment or a skills assessment for the job or the role that they may have, but really do a deep assessment on the cultural fit and ensuring that they can be successful here. Because otherwise, you end up bringing people, let's say, you know, and I keep telling people, don't just fill a job because there's a job that needs to be done and you need somebody right away, right? Take your time, make sure you have the right person, because you might lose a few weeks up front, but in the long run, that doesn't completely pales in comparison to what you actually get out of it, right? So I advise managers to take their time, hire for culture, don't hire necessarily for comfort. Don't hire for people that think like you or look like you or act like you. Diversity, I think, is very important in all ways. But ultimately, the values are where the culture comes in. What you value and what they value, at least you should be able to see eye to eye. And then the technical skills, I'm pretty sure, is going to be important, or whatever the skill is for that particular job is important, right?
I think that's the sad thing sometimes with large companies is that you get these requisitions open, and then it's like, this requisition's been open too long. Apparently, you don't need this. You know, you get someone saying, you don't need this person anymore because you've had it open for 2 months. And it's like, you know, and so you get into that mode of like, if I don't put a warm body into it, then it's going to go away. And it's nice to hear you say that, you know, it's about finding the right individual. You know, we definitely do that at Evotech too. I think it's not about the time that the rec's been open, but I've definitely worked for places that becomes the driving force, and it's like, get it done or it's going to go away. And
it's not just bringing the right person in. We need to keep them motivated, which basically means giving them the right projects, the right exposure, the right career path. You know, all these things matter.
Yeah.
You know, people ask me, what is the greatest asset of a tech company? It is the people.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's what's in our brains that matter. And that's how value gets created, right? So if you don't treat your team members as the greatest assets of the organization, then you're missing out. It's not the technology. It's not the buildings and all the stuff that we own. It's who walks in and walks out of the door every day.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's very true. Very true. How do you balance sort of the technical and product side of things with the people side and just organizationally and kind of, obviously you can't be everywhere all at the same time, but how do you approach that and how do you make that happen every day?
Yeah, I think, it's, as I said, I think the number one job at a CEO level or leadership level is really to ensure that you set the right vision and the course and get alignment across all the teams to go execute it, right? And as long as you do that and hope that you have the right people to take you there. And if you don't, then you make the corrections as you go, right? And keep evaluating against that, right? That sort of, at the 50,000 foot level, is job, right? But there's a lot of details to it, right? Every day, right? Making sure the numbers are coming in correctly for the quarter that was projected, making sure the product milestones are being met on time, making sure the customer issues that might be there are getting resolved on time, right? All of these are day in the life of a leader. But there's also, and that to me is sort of what I call the flywheel, right? You just have to be on it and keep running. But every once in a while, you need to have a slower thread in your brain as well. While that fast thread is going, the slower thread needs to be about strategy. Are we doing the right things for the long term? Are we making the right bets to be relevant 2 years from now, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, right? Those are threads that have to keep going on in the background, and you have to engage the organization at that level as well. Through offsites, through deep conversations about strategy, organization evolution, and things like that, and those things all don't happen at the same time. This month is for me, it's about product strategy. Last month was about, we were coming out of the pandemic, and the pandemic certainly threw us all off gear, so we had to adjust and stuff like that. So it's evaluating, are we positioned well for a rebound as we come out of the pandemic? So the slow thread, if you will, varies quite a bit in terms of week after week, month after month. And you have to make very conscious, thoughtful calls on where you want to spend your time on the slow thread. On the fast thread, which is where most of your time gets spent, it's pretty much spoken for in terms of what the organization wants and responding to the customer's needs and so on.
Yeah, it's almost like that fast thread sort of going all the time, no matter whether you're on it or not. And so you have to,
it is.
To get on it, and then you have to maybe take some time away from it to think about the strategy and the some of the longer term stuff. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cause if you stay on that thing all the time, you'll just, you know, it'll just eat you alive, you know.
You lose sight of where you're going, right?
And yeah.
That's not the job, right? That's important to keep it going, but you also need to make sure you're headed in the right direction.
I like the flywheel analogy.
I think that slow thread gives you that opportunity to, you know, take that step back and, you know, absorb new ideas and new thoughts, you know, really think about things a little bit differently, you know. I recommitted myself to reading, a couple years ago, seeing like, you know, guys like Gates and Bubba talk about how much they read, right? And those guys are insanely busy already, right? But they make time for that. And I try to do the same. I tried to, you know, like a couple years ago, I decided I would do the same for myself. And like, I found, you know, doing that and that slow track of like, you know, onboarding new ideas, using those to reevaluate that strategic path you're on, I think is super important. So
Easy
to stay on the flywheel, right?
It is absolutely. And you need to once in a while take a time out, and maybe it's just a mental timeout, right? You're going to spend some time. I mean, our brains are 24/7, even though we're not at work or whatever, we are always thinking. So it's that allowing you to process the slow thread at its own pace and have it unravel whatever lies on the other side, right?
So Sean, are you reading 10 books a week?
I am not reading 10 books. I try to go to one a month. No,
I'm glad to hear that. It's not easy to pull off. Kirti, one question I had for you. We talked about this a little bit with the pandemic. What do you hope that we keep? Like, there's been a lot of things that have come up during the last 6 months that we're doing differently. What are you most hopeful that we kind of keep going after we kind of hopefully get back into some kind of whatever the next, you know, normal looks like? Are there things you're like, I hope we keep this going as a company, as an organization, as a team?
You know, to me, I'll tell you, it's a silly thing, but I think it's evocative of a broader point, which is that we find ourselves completely comfortable talking to each other about work in t-shirts and shorts. You know, this is executives, this could be engineers, it doesn't matter, right? But we are doing very serious work. You don't have to be in a suit and tie to do serious work. And I think that is, it's a silly thing, but I think it is, I think, broken the barrier of, you know, a level of formality that sometimes got in the way. And I think the ability to now do work with your colleagues, with your customers, with the industry at large, and having serious conversations, serious chats about making a difference without having that artificial barrier, if you will, is I think a good thing. And I hope we continue to keep that thing about inviting customers into our homes virtually and vice versa, right? It's just, I think that's how life is and life should be. And this barrier of work and personal life and work life is sort of an artificial barrier we create. And it's important for balance, don't get me wrong. But at the same time, it doesn't need to be a hard barrier. It can be much more malleable and going back and forth.
Hey, I'll vote for a second on the wearing shorts going forward. For sure.
Yeah. Hey, we're all sitting around, so who cares? Right? It's summer. Enjoy the weather.
It's hot, yes. Exactly. You know, you talked a little bit about this before too, and we just have a couple minutes left. And you talked a little bit about some of the what you're seeing with customers or clients and the change to kind of being at home. I'm curious, you know, anything? Are there any other things that you're talking? I mean, you probably talked to a lot of customers and everything. I'm just curious if you have any other thoughts or what you're seeing that. major takeaways that would be that you'd love to hear that from you.
Yeah, I think, you know, the big imperatives, right, is I think the idea of working in a flexible way, in a hybrid way between the home and the work, I think is here to stay. I think it's a long-term trend. I think you'll see a lot more remote work become very, not only viable, but maybe preferred in many organizations. So it doesn't mean the office goes away by any means, but I think the way we work, I think, will change in a big way. So I think that is a very key takeaway that will affect, I think, for years to come, the technology industry and the landscape and what we build for the industry. The second one is, I think, more tactical near term, which is a lot of us do have to go to work to do make stuff like factory floors or kitchens, or, you know, these are all places that are not automated, and we can't just sit in our computers and make burgers, for example. Right? So there's a huge number of people in the workforce that must go into work. They can't just stay at home. And how do we make sure that those places are safe is a very important priority as well. And there's, again, technology can be a big, can have a big role to play in that area, right? In terms of ensuring social distancing is observed properly, that you could potentially do things like contact tracing if in fact somebody gets impacted by COVID. So I think worker safety and ensuring the workplace is a safe place to be, I think is another big sort of trend that I see. And the third is everybody in the next year or so is going to look at IT budgets and go, what am I going to do different? Because my revenues are a little bit lower. And so I have to adjust my IT budgets to accommodate for that. And but at the same time, I got to accommodate all my remote workers, and I have to keep my office space safe. So what gives, right? And so I think there will be opportunities to shift the spend in areas that matter more and reduce spend where it may be less relevant. And I see technologies like SD-WAN connecting to the cloud as becoming that opportunity to both evolve to the future and save money at the same time. And so I think those are sort of the areas that I'm seeing sort of a lot of interest in the customer base right now.
Nice.
I was just going to comment there too. I mean, I think I've always seen Aruba as a very security oriented company. And I think that's another area in which we're seeing, you know, this COVID thing really stressed a lot of businesses, right? Like you're especially your traditional, like, you know, like let's say financial services, right? Where everybody shows up every day, that everybody's in a suit, right? And that was like the norm, right? And all of a sudden now it's like, nobody's there. Everybody's remote. How do we deal with all this financial data that's, you know, spread out all over the country now? And I think, you know, a lot of what you guys are doing is also embraces that, and a lot of my projects and you know, other products here at Evotech have been trying to solve those, you know, those issues for our customers, and a lot of the Aruba technology is at the forefront of solving that from a security standpoint as well.
No, absolutely. I think that is as things get more distributed, right? Security is one of the biggest concerns, right? How do you still make sure that everything is compliant with the security policy that the corporation might have? So visibility and ensuring that things are still secure, I think, and making sure they are secure from the ground up, I think, is absolutely a huge priority.
So do you guys think that the financial services guys are still wearing their ties in their Zoom meeting, but maybe wearing shorts, you know, with a...
I think so. I think that is what's really happening.
Exactly. Well, Kirti, I really appreciate you taking the time. I actually feel more at peace just talking to you for an hour. Like, it's been really cool. I've learned a lot, and I think our listeners will too. And thank you so much.
My pleasure. It's a pleasure to again be a partner of Evotech. And you know, I wish all of you a happy Labor Day weekend here that's coming up. And I hope to again connect with you virtually, hopefully sometime soon in front of customers. But if you ever need to get a hold of any of us at Aruba, feel free to drop us a note. We are always there.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thank you, Sean, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kirti. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Paul.
All right. Have a great day. Have a great Labor Day. See you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
For a chance to win a 32-inch HP LED monitor, please enter our raffle at evotech.com/TNT26. All entries must be submitted by September 18th, 2020. Drawing will be held and announced on September 21st, 2020.
Thank you for listening to another edition of the TNT podcast, Technology and Things, hosted by Paul Ferraro and Jeff Kruger. We'll see you next time.